Okay, well, raise your hand if you have been to a wedding this past spring, summer. Okay, summer's kind of a busy time for weddings. What is your favorite part of the wedding day? The reception, all right. The pictures, really? Getting dressed up and taking pictures is like the worst part. Our kids get most excited about the cake, obviously. Just the whole excitement, though, of the decorations and the, you know, it's a big day and everybody's, you know, dressed up. And the reception can be fun if you're a fan of, you know, good food and the dessert and the dancing and the music and all that. Laughter, maybe meeting up with people that you haven't seen in a while. Sometimes the toasts, the speeches from the best man and the maid of honor, sometimes those are pretty good, and sometimes it's kind of like more embarrassing than anything, right? How long, the last wedding that you went to, how long did it last? Too long? Yeah, stoners had a long day. Long weekend there, right? Maybe on the shorter end, an American wedding these days, 3 to 4 hours, right? Maybe on the long end, 6 to 8 hours, something like that. If you're a close family member, part of it, you know, it kind of takes up your whole weekend with the rehearsal and all that. Can you imagine a wedding celebration that lasts 4, 5, 6, 7 days? Can you imagine that? And that's actually what most of the, I don't want to say most of the world, a large portion of the world has done and still does to celebrate weddings. They make a big spectacle of it. It's the main thing. And so as we come to read this morning about the wedding feast at Cana, we need to kind of set some things straight, because what we think of as a wedding and what the first century audience would have thought of as a wedding is a little bit different. So weddings are a big deal in our country at this time. But they were even bigger, even more important in the time of Jesus, and again, still in many parts of the world. In Jesus' day, weddings would last anywhere from 4 to 7 days. It was one of the biggest community events. Of course, the Jews had their feast days, and there were some other possibly big events, but the wedding feast was a huge event, and the whole community was involved. The whole village would have been invited, and this is what kids, there's actually a section in Matthew's gospel that leads you to believe that kids would play wedding. They would that was like their, you know, when they're act like, you know how kids play school, or they would play wedding because that was the big, like, monumental thing in their lives. And so the whole town was included. They didn't send out invitations like we do now. It's just everybody in the village knew that this is what was going on, and everybody was a part of it. Wedding was not seen as it often is in our day, as just a matter of the bride and groom's kind of personal happiness. Like, this is something they want to do, and we're happy for them, and it's all about them being happy. Instead, marriage was seen as a fundamental building block of the community. The strength of this marriage that's happening is pivotal for the strength of the village, for the strength of the community, the strength of the economy, the strength of the families here. And so it was much more seen as like a communal. There was a more communal view of marriage, not just it's good for the bride and groom and their personal happiness. It's good for everybody. It's good for the whole village. And so they had this, you know, week long celebration to do that. It was a time of feasting, good food, wine, music, storytelling. If you've ever seen a movie or video of a Jewish wedding, a lot of those things have trickled down through the centuries. The dancing, the, you know, big circle dancing, loud music, all that, that's all part. Kids running around, the whole town participating, and, you know, just doing the bare minimum of chores at home so you can, you know, come back and be part of the ongoing celebration. Especially if you lived in a poorer village, to have a big feast would have been really special. You know, as Americans, we're wealthy enough, we can pretty much have a feast every meal if we want. But for them, this is a pretty meager meals most of the time, but then to have a feast and an ongoing feast. This would have been really exciting. The new husband, the groom, the bridegroom, was responsible for the week-long party. It was very important that he provide a great party for everyone. For him to throw a bad party would have brought shame on him and on his family and on the community. And so if you've never talked about this or heard about this. There's a difference. Our culture is what's known as a guilt culture. And there are some other cultures that are known as honor and shame culture. And so we tell our kids, you know, don't be a bad boy or don't be a bad girl. In the Middle East, they say, don't bring dishonor to the family. Don't disgrace the family. And so there's just a little different of an emphasis of why you should be good or why you shouldn't be bad. Here we emphasize guilt. There they emphasize shame. And so for the bridegroom to not throw a good party, for example, to run out of refreshments, to run out of food or wine, would have brought shame to him and to his family. And actually, there's some evidence from the first century that the bridegroom could be on the receiving end of a lawsuit from the bride's family if he didn't throw a good enough party, if it brought shame to them. So you and I have probably all been to some weddings where something happened that was like, oh, it kind of stands out in your mind. But this would have been so serious if you had messed up the wedding party that you would have been known like for the rest of your life. That's the couple that ran out of wine at the wedding feast, and it would have been horribly humiliating and kind of branded them for the rest of their lives. And so what the bridegroom would do then is he would hire someone to be kind of the master of ceremonies at the wedding reception. The master of the banquet or the steward of the banquet, the head waiter, somebody that's in charge, making sure everything's running smoothly. We still do this, right? You get somebody to kind of make sure everything's going well in the kitchen, and you get a DJ to make sure everything's moving along and that kind of thing. And so this is the environment. This is the kind of wedding that we encounter in John chapter 2. We're going to read the section, the passage is just short. It's 11 verses. This is a passage that I think everybody's familiar with. Even a lot of non-Christians know that Jesus turned water to wine. And I think it's easy just to read this kind of story at a real superficial level, one that we're familiar with and kind of, oh, yeah, I know that's a story and that's exciting. That's interesting. But hopefully this morning we can go a little bit deeper. So let's read the text here. John chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the wine that had been turned into wine. I'm sorry, the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. Okay, so a couple just quick observations, and then I'm going to have five points for you this morning. The third day, the passage says, on the third day, a wedding took place at Cana. The third day is the third day. Some people think it's the third day after Jesus was with John by the Jordan, but that would be a little bit hard for all the things that have happened in John chapter 1, and then to get all the way out to Cana would probably be too difficult. So I think this is probably better to be understood as the third day after what we've just read. At the end of chapter 1, Jesus' encounter with Nathanael, he's collected these now five men following him, and so they're now coming with him. So this is the third day. It'd probably take a couple days to travel out to Cana. There's a map here. You can send that map up there. So you see the Sea of Galilee right there, kind of off to the right. They had been in Bethsaida. That was where Andrew and Philip were from. And so they'd have to travel southwest. I don't know if you can see right kind of smack dab in the middle is Cana. It's just about eight miles north and east of Nazareth, which is where Jesus had been raised. So just to give you, they've been coming from the Jordan River up north of the Sea of Galilee, down through Bethsaida, and then on towards Cana. It says this is the first of his signs. John uses the word signs when telling about Jesus's miracles. And this is the first one. Some people will say that there are seven miraculous signs in the Gospel of John. I don't know if it fits that quite that neatly, but we can kind of explore that as we go on through later chapters here. An interesting thing to think about, one author I read this week said that the fact that this is the first miracle recorded in John's Gospel is evidence that this is real eyewitness testimony. And the reason that we can conclude that is because this would be an odd one to make up as the first miracle for Jesus. It'd be an odd one to make up. If you're just making up a myth of a special man, you would want to pick the biggest, the most spectacular, like the kind of quintessential miracle first. And so you would pick, you know, healing the blind or raising the dead or something like that. And this one's just helping a newlywed couple not be embarrassed at their wedding ceremony, at their reception. And so, you know, why would they? And here's the quote. This is from a professor at Duke University. His name is Reynolds Price. He says the Gospel of John was from the hand of a clear-minded, thoughtful eyewitness to the acts and mind of Jesus. Why invent for the inaugural sign of Jesus's great career a miraculous solution to a mere social oversight? So this is not the kind of thing that would be made up. And so it has the ring of he's telling the truth. This is just what happened. Okay, I want to take you through five different kind of areas of things to think about, and we'll kind of work through the text as we go. The first thing I want to explore with you is Jesus' relationship with his mother. It's interesting, in John's Gospel, Mary is never actually mentioned by name. She's always referred to as Jesus' mother. And so twice in this passage, she's referred to as Jesus' mother. It seems likely that Mary and therefore Jesus were probably related to the bride or groom. That's why they were invited. And not sure why the disciples were invited, but it says they were invited also. If you look down in verse 12, you'll see that actually Jesus' brothers were there also. Jesus' brothers, his siblings, were also at the wedding feast. And so it's not clear. There's the master of the banquet or the master of the feast that we read about later. It seems like Mary may have some responsibility also, that maybe she was part of the catering team. And so she realizes that the wine is running out or is already out. And so she brings that that to Jesus's attention. It does seem like just this is who Mary is. This is the kind of woman that she is, that she has this concern, this compassion for this newlywed, these newlyweds. She wants to help. And so she goes and gets Jesus's attention. So again, Mary is ever the example of tenderness and love and concern here. Why did Mary go to Jesus? Well, a couple things to think about here. One reason is that at this point, it is likely that Joseph, Jesus' adoptive dad, has died. Okay, so in Mark 6, Jesus is referred to as the carpenter. Other places here he's referred to as the carpenter's son, but then later he's referred to as the carpenter. So it seems like at some point, not sure how old Jesus would have been, but Joseph died. He's not there. Remember at the cross, Jesus says to John, you know, behold your mother, basically asking John to take care of his mom. And because Joseph is not around anymore. So it seems likely that that's not recorded in Scripture how he died or when he died. But it seems that like that's probably what happened. And so Jesus would have taken over the family business. He's the oldest son. And so it's likely that Mary has learned to rely on Jesus because he's had to become the man of the home and be the provider for the family, you know, as after Joseph passed. And so from maybe a late teenager or early 20s, Jesus has been caring for the family, providing for the family. And so Mary has come to rely on Jesus and lean on him. And obviously, you know, there's other things about Jesus. She remembers the visit from Gabriel. There's, I'm sure, things that have happened through Jesus's childhood where she knows this is, you know, this is an extraordinary child, and she's come to learn, you know, rely on his wisdom and, you know, his helpfulness, and, you know, he's never sinned. I mean, that alone would get your attention as a mom, right? So Jesus has proved himself time and time again. And so, Young Bucks, I want you to take a little notice here that Jesus was known to his mom as being reliable and responsible. So, Young Bucks, maybe we'll have to hit this again tonight at Young Bucks, but you should be known to your mom. Your mom should know you as somebody I can rely on. If I need a job done at home, I can count on my son. I can call him and he's going to help. He's going to help me take care of things. And so Mary goes to Jesus to get help. When Mary tells Jesus of the wine running out, he addresses her as dear woman. Some translations simply say woman. So it's just trying to translate that accurately. In that culture, some people take issue with this. Well, Jesus doesn't seem like he's speaking very respectfully to his mother by calling her woman or dear woman. In that culture, this is a common way for a man to address an adult woman. It does seem like not real affectionate, but he's an adult, and so he's not calling her mommy, you know. He's an adult, and so he says, dear woman. It's not kind of that, like, redneck, hey, woman, you know. It's not like that. It's dear woman. And so I got that down pretty good, huh? The word he says here is the same word that he uses when he addresses her from the cross. Remember, she's at the foot of the cross. She and John are there, and she says, woman, behold your son. Son, behold, you know, John, behold your mother, and woman, behold your son. Same word there. It's a tender, respectful word. So Jesus honored his mother. So there again, young bucks and fair maidens there. Jesus honored his mother. There does still seem to be this like hint of a rebuke. He says, why do you involve me? My time has not yet come. Or the better translation is, my hour has not yet come. Why do you involve me? And not sure how to take that. It does seem like a bit of a rebuke. There are a couple different ways of kind of reading that. One possibility is that Jesus is just being kind of playful. Why are you getting me involved? Like if Nora asks me for, you know, hey, Daddy, can we go get ice cream? I might say, why do you think I'd want to go get ice cream with you? Even though I'm planning to go get ice cream with her. Just kind of being playful and kind of drawing her out a little bit. So it's possible that Jesus is doing that. It's possible also that Jesus is trying to draw her attention to something important. And so we'll say more about that. When Jesus talks about his hour, what is he talking about? And that's kind of left for the reader of John's gospel. What is Jesus's hour? That's an unusual phrase. We don't say that. I don't talk about my hour or your hour. So what is Jesus talking about? And that phrase, it's almost like a formal word that Jesus uses. And he has a very specific idea of what he's talking about. And it's left, for, you know, as we continue through John to get more detail about what that is. So his response is a little maybe confusing. What is he talking about? And I think that might be a little bit intentional. Some people have suggested that Jesus is actually also rebuking Mary a little bit, that perhaps Mary has some pride tied up in this, and that she's coming to Jesus and saying, you know, Jesus, do something, almost trying to say, Jesus, show them who you are. Now's the time to reveal yourself. Do something miraculous, take care of this. And, you know, maybe that she would like, oh, that's my boy, you know. And so it's possible that Jesus is rebuking her a little bit. That's just speculation. I don't know that that's clear. It does seem like Jesus at some point maybe would have had to change the dynamic. That Jesus has always been Mary's little boy. And, you know, that dynamic is always there for a son as he gets older. I'm not your little boy anymore, Mom. I'm an adult. And so as you've been kind of like calling the shots and I've been submissive living in your home, but now I'm on this other mission and you can't call the shots anymore now. And so I'm in this ministry and I'm on this road to the cross and you don't get to, you know, boss me around. So that's possible that that's going on in there also. The thing I love about Mary's response is that Mary, when he says, why do you involve me? Mary doesn't get all huffy and who do you think you are talking to your mother like that? You know, she doesn't get all huffy. She persists. She says, do whatever he tells you. Do whatever he tells you. And so she's not, it seems like, maybe even changing in this passage, realizing I'm not Jesus's boss anymore. He's in charge. Do whatever he tells you. And so she's an example for us of patience and obedience and faith. And so some good things there. Are those coming up? Yeah, good. Well, let's move on to the next point here. So she says, do whatever he tells you. And the second thing we can learn here is that obedience invites blessing. I think this is a great motto for life. If you're a Christian, Mary's phrase here, do whatever he tells you. What a great motto. I'm going to do whatever he tells me. Whatever Jesus says, that's what I'm going to do. He's the Lord. He's the King. He's the Master. If Jesus asks me to do something, it might not be the easiest path. It might not be the path that makes sense to me from my vantage point. But he's God. This is the path of life. Jesus is the way. He's the way, the truth, and life. He's the way. Whatever way he says to go, I'm going to go. And so Mary obeys Jesus, and she encourages the servants to obey him, and they do. And I wonder if, obviously there's things left out here. You know, it's not exhaustive. It doesn't give every detail of what happened at the wedding feast. So there had to be some point where Jesus says, go fill them up with water. And they're like, what? No, they ran out of wine. They didn't run out of water. They ran out of wine. Filling up the jars up with water, that's... What's that going to accomplish? This could cost us our jobs. If we go to the master of the banquet with jars of water when he's looking for wine, we're going to be in trouble, right? So, like, excuse me, Jesus, what are you saying? Fill him up with water? What are you going to do? Maybe they had some, like, powder that they could pour in and stir it up and instant wine or something. No, that's not how it works. I imagine Jesus just kind of looking at them and saying, just trust me. Just trust me. Just do what I'm asking you to do. Just trust me. So it's not quite clear why these servants listened to Mary and why they listened to Jesus, but they did obey. And again, perhaps at some risk to themselves. We don't read that they tasted it first. They just did what Jesus asked and brought it to the master of the banquet. It doesn't say when exactly the water turned to wine, but by the time they get this water to the master of ceremonies, it's changed. And I wonder what was their reaction. I don't know if the master of ceremonies was aware of the situation. You know, if he's like pretty nervous and then all of a sudden tastes this wine and he realizes his hide has been saved. I wonder what the servant's reaction was when they see the master of ceremony, the master of the banquet, he takes a sip and this is the best wine. Why'd you save the best wine to last? And if the servants were like, what was their facial expression? Like, oh, we're saved. Mary and the servants are examples for us of simple trust and obedience. And I just, again, challenge, this should be our attitude. This should be the attitude of our hearts in our life. I'll just do whatever he tells me. He says, forgive those who wrong me. That doesn't make sense. I want to get revenge, but I'm going to do what he tells me. He says to give generously. I don't want to give generously. I want to keep everything for myself. But I'm going to listen to him. I'm going to obey him. He knows better. He says to love my enemies. That doesn't make sense. But I'm going to do that. I'm going to trust him. And I do think that this is Jesus' attitude with us often. Just trust me. I'm telling you these things for your good. Just trust me. Just obey. You'll see. Don't let that questioning cause you to disobey Jesus, that doubt. Okay, let's move on to number three. So we're talking about Jesus' relationship with his mother, and then this obedience invites blessing. And I'll just say, obedience invites blessing. The blessing is not always going to be more wine or more money or whatever. We're not a prosperity gospel church. We don't say, oh, you just obey Jesus and everything's going to go fine for you. The blessing might come in intimacy with Christ. Some people who've been in prison, you know, persecuted for their faith, they will say that was a time of great blessing because of the intimacy I shared. Even when my body was being tortured or, you know, I was not getting anything to eat, the blessing was in this communion with this fellowship with Christ. So the obedience, the blessing that comes might not be the same in every situation. It won't be the same in every situation. All right, let's look at some of Jesus's values. I think this passage makes it clear that Jesus is approving of some things or affirming of certain things. And so first here, Jesus is affirming, I think, in this passage, the goodness of marriage. The goodness of marriage. He's there to celebrate with the newlyweds and the other guests. Some people have twisted the message of the Bible to say that marriage is actually bad and sexual relations are bad. But that is not the message of the Bible. God is not anti-marriage. In fact, God designed marriage and even brought the first woman to the first man and gave her away in the first wedding ceremony, so to speak. there are times and certain individuals that should not get married. Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians 7. Remember we read about that? But Jesus loves marriage and he loves married couples. He loves singles too. His goal is that whether you're single or married, whatever is your station in life, that you would honor God with that, that you would bring glory to him in that situation as a single or as a married couple. But Jesus affirms the goodness of marriage. Marriage is a good thing. Secondly, Jesus also affirms the goodness of social interaction and even parties. Often we'll say, well, so-and-so goes to parties and that's like a bad thing. No, parties are not. There are certain things at parties that can be bad at some parties, right? But parties, banquets, feasting, music, laughter, talking, these are all good things. And so Jesus, if you read the Gospels, Jesus goes to a number of parties. And even a party where there's drinking of alcoholic beverages. I think this is something that's important to realize, that this is something that Jesus values. And it's not just that Jesus is there and he's preaching the whole time. You get the sense that Jesus is part of the festivities. Part of the festivities. Enjoying the feast. Participating in the dancing. Not certain kinds of dancing, but dancing is not sinful in itself. And so Jesus is trying to communicate, I think, through this, that there's value in the sharing of a good time, sharing in social interaction, the relationships. This is all important. It's important for us when we're here on Sunday mornings. That's why we encourage you not to rush off. When we have a church picnic, you should show up to that. And you should show up early for a life group and stick around afterwards and enjoy that time of eating snacks. It's not like less. It's all important. You don't want to say the Bible study is important and then you can just, you know, shove off and not be involved in the relationships. The relationships are important. That's a really valuable thing. The world thinks they have a monopoly on parties, like we're the experts of partying. No, God is the master of parties. God is the master of banquets. In fact, heaven is described as a great party, a great feast. Jesus says they'll come from the east and the west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob at the feast. Right? He tells this parable of a great wedding banquet. Everybody's invited. And it's this lavish party. And that's a picture of the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven. So there's goodness. Jesus is affirming the goodness of social interactions and parties. Again here, the goodness of feasts. Jesus affirms the goodness of feasts. So John the Baptist came and he was, remember, had this kind of meager diet of wild honey and locusts. John came fasting, but Jesus came feasting. There's a time in the Christian life to fast. There's some description of that in the New Testament, that fasting is appropriate. But there's also a time when feasting is appropriate. So the Christian life is not all fasting. It's not all feasting. There's times to fast, and then there's times to feast. And I think we've lost this. You know, we live in a world of going through the drive-thru and microwavable meals. And not that those things are always bad. I don't want to say that. But it's really good. It would be bad to get out of the habit of being able to sit back and enjoy a nice long meal with people that you love, with family, with extended family, with good friends. And just to linger over the meal, not to wolf it down and get off to the next thing or whatever, but just to talk and to laugh and to tell stories and to have some music on in the background. Again, I think we've lost that quite a bit as in our American culture. And so it's good for us to, you know, keep that, to have a feast from time to time, to celebrate, whether it's a birthday or an anniversary or, hey, we just want to get our close friends together. Feasts are good. And then lastly here, I don't know if this will be controversial for some of you, but Jesus also affirms the goodness of wine. Jesus affirms the goodness of wine. Some people have said that this wine that Jesus makes is not alcoholic, but the word wine here is the same word in Ephesians 5 when we are warned not to get drunk on wine. So it seems like this is definitely alcoholic wine. It is likely that the alcoholic content was lower. We're not sure exactly how much lower, but probably lower than most alcoholic beverages today. But it was alcoholic. Would Jesus have turned water into wine if wine was inherently sinful? Of course not. In fact, and we're going to spend more time on this next week. There's obviously some issues. Maybe this raises issues for some of you. But if you look at the whole testimony of the Bible about wine is actually seen as and an indication of God's blessing. It's something that's good. Obviously, drunkenness is bad. That's consistent also, Old and New Testament. Drunkenness is sinful. To not have self-control, that's sinful. Self-control is a fruit of the Spirit. But Jesus drank wine. Later, Jesus uses wine at the Last Supper. Some people will unfortunately take this passage of Scripture and they'll kind of chuckle when Jesus turned water into wine and use that as a license for like, oh, Jesus turned water into wine. I'm going to drink all I want. You know, obviously that would be sinful. So I think there's kind of a balance here, as with many things. And sometimes we don't like finding the balance. We don't like finding the middle ground. We tend towards extremes sometimes. There's kind of two extremes here. One is alcohol itself is sinful. Even to touch it would be bad. Obviously, Jesus doesn't have that view. Another extreme is wine is this great good and we can get drunk. And in the middle is wine is a blessing, but it should be used appropriately. So I'll leave it at that. And Sean will probably have more to say to clarify some things about alcohol and then maybe some broader application next week. Okay, let's turn now to the character of Jesus, So we've seen his value system, his relationship with his mom, and the importance of obedience and invites blessing, the character of Jesus. And first, we notice here in this passage is just Jesus's power. Jesus's power to change water to wine. Can you imagine having that kind of power? Sometimes it's in like kids shows or movies, and you know that you have the power to like zap something and turn it. There's a great Sesame Street episode I saw one time where Cookie Monster could turn anything into a cookie. It's like, man, that would be an awesome power to turn stuff, to turn one thing into a totally different thing. But remember that Jesus is God. Remember? Remember from the first chapter? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning, and through him all things were made. Nothing was made without him. And so Jesus had made everything, had made the whole universe out of nothing. And so to turn water to wine is not really a challenge for him. He's almighty. He's all powerful. If we had this kind of power to change one thing into another thing, we would misuse it, right? We would use it selfishly, sinfully. But Jesus never used his power selfishly, not for self-gratification. In fact, on one occasion, he refused even to turn stones into bread to nourish himself. He never used his power for himself, always for the good of others. We also see here Jesus's compassion. Jesus's compassion, not only his power, also his compassion. He has compassion for this young married couple who's about to be shamed socially for running out of wine. And again, it seems like a small concern almost compared to some other things. It was a big concern for them, but almost a small concern compared to healing the sick and healing the blind and raising somebody from the dead. But Jesus cares about the small concerns. He cares about the small details of our lives. Now, instead of this couple being known as, oh, that's the couple that ran out of wine, they're going to be known as the couple that saved the best wine to last, which is kind of exciting, kind of a unique little label for them. Another demonstration of Jesus's compassion in this account is that Jesus reveals himself to the lowly servants and to his fishermen disciples, and not to the wealthy, influential guests that might have been there. And isn't that the way? Same thing at Jesus' birth. The first people that come are the shepherds, the lowly shepherds. Jesus has a special heart for the lowly, the outcasts, the hurting. We see his power. We see his compassion. We also see his extravagant blessing. And here, both in quantity of wine and quality of wine, Jesus produces a lot of wine, 6 stone jars, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. And I think that amount is like a little bit of a guesstimate. It's close, but it's a ton of wine. And if you just take our normal gallons, which, again, I'm not sure if it's exactly like that, but our normal gallons, we're talking about between 400 to 450 cups of wine, like enough wine to finish the feast. And maybe some leftovers. Remember when he multiplied the loaves and the fishes, there were baskets full left over at the end. So I imagine something like that here. Jesus made plenty. They weren't going to run out again. So there's plenty. Jesus blesses them with quantity, but also with quality. Jesus doesn't make cheap wine or bad wine. He makes the best wine. to the amazement of the banquet master and the other guests. The world is going to tell us we've got the best. But if you follow Jesus for any length of time, you know, no, Jesus gives the best gifts. You can shout all day long about how good your pleasures are, world. But Jesus gives the best. And sometimes the best comes later. Sometimes the immediate, it's difficult. There's a hard road to tread. But the best gifts in the kingdom come last. Lastly here, Jesus' humility. So his compassion, his power, his blessing, his extravagant blessing, his humility. Notice that Jesus doesn't make a big show to draw attention to himself. It seems like at the end of this, only the servants and the disciples and Mary know what has happened. And you think about our culture, it's all like chest pounding. And when they hit a home run, they toss the bat. And, you know, we've got the humble brag and mic drops and all this, things to draw attention to ourselves. And how I dominated that, you know. And Jesus doesn't do that. He's humble in this. He's revealing his glory gradually, slowly, not overpowering, not overwhelming anybody. Jesus is truly humble. And I just want to say here, this is just a little sampling, probably other things to learn about Jesus here. But we say that Jesus is powerful. He's compassionate. He gives extravagant blessings. He's humble. Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. We read in Hebrews 13. So what we've read about Jesus here, this is who he still is. He's still compassionate. He's still powerful. He still wants to bring good blessing into your life. So, all right, let's move on to the last point here. Jesus's mission. This passage teaches us some things about Jesus's mission. Notice that Jesus deliberately chooses these stone jars. And the stone jars, it says, were normally used for purification. So remember that the Jews had a number of different rituals, purification rituals. And so there are ceremonial washings that had to happen. Now, I assume since they've run out of wine that there were other empty jars laying around. There were empty wine jars, right? But Jesus chooses, he says, fill those up with water. Fill up these purification jars with wine. Why is Jesus deliberately repurposing these purification jars and using them to turn water into wine? And I said, I think he wants to teach. He wants to drop a hint. He wants to leave people in suspense. Get them thinking. Get them thinking a new direction. Jesus does this on another occasion. In John 6, we're going to read, Jesus has just multiplied the loaves and the fishes. And then there's this discussion. They're in the boat, I think. And the apostles are talking about bread. And Jesus overhears them. Hears this discussion. And he uses their discussion about physical bread to start talking about himself and who he is and what he's come to do. And he says that he's the bread of life. And so I think Jesus is doing that here. Mary has brought this request to him about wine. They've run out of wine at the party. And now Jesus is going to use this time to show them something about the true wine, or the wine that is the fulfillment of this wine. So a couple of things I want to say here. First, it's been pointed out that Jesus is probably, through this miracle, transitioning to a new covenant. He's showing that there's this transition. And there was in the Old Testament, there was kind of word that there's going to be a new covenant. And now Jesus is showing that this new covenant is on the way in. The new covenant has arrived. The purification rituals were associated with Old Testament law, the Old Covenant. And Jesus is saying, now that's on its way out, and now the wine of feasting, the wine of blessing is here. Okay, and so those old covenant things are starting to move out. Later, Jesus is going to refer to this as old wineskins and new wineskins. There's an old covenant with old wineskins, and now there's this new covenant with new wineskins. And so get used to, there's some differences here. It's not all about following the same old rules of the Mosaic covenant. So this is a new season of God's working in the world. Another thing here is that Jesus is announcing the arrival of the Messianic kingdom. This goes together. This goes together with that first one there. But Jesus is announcing the arrival of the Messianic kingdom. So again, all through the Old Testament, there's this expectation. There's this Messiah coming. There's these prophecies. There's this Messiah coming. What is he going to be like? And we know a lot of the details of what the Messiah himself will be like. But there's also details given about what the Messiah's reign will be like, what his kingdom will be like. And so here's a couple descriptions. There are a number of these in the Old Testament. Jeremiah 31, verse 12. They will come and shout for joy on the heights of Zion. They will rejoice in the bounty of the Lord, the grain, the new wine, and the oil, the young of the flocks and herds. They will be like a well-watered garden. And they will sorrow no more. So this Messiah will bring in this new season, this new age of joy and bounty and new wine even. And they'll be like a well-watered garden. Joel 3:18, in that day, the mountains will drip new wine and the hills will flow with milk. All the ravines of Judah will run with water. A fountain will flow out of the Lord's house and will water the valley of acacias. That's a kind of tree. And so in this miracle, Jesus is showing, he's saying, I am the Messiah, and this is the kind of kingdom I want you to get used to, a whole new kind of blessing, a whole new kind of season where you'll know me and you'll experience this blessing. Later, Jesus is going to say, I've come to bring you life so that you may have it abundantly. Right? That's not what they had experienced in the old covenant. That's what they're going to experience now in following Christ. A third thing here Jesus is explaining about his mission, or at least foreshadowing with his mission, is that he's looking forward to his whole rescue mission, which includes his death and his resurrection. Again, I mentioned that Jesus says his time has not yet come. It's maybe better translated. Some translations have, my hour has not yet come. And that hour, my hour, has a very specific meaning. It's 9 times in the Gospel of John that you read about Jesus talking about his hour. At the beginning, he's saying, my hour has not yet come. And then when you get to like right before he dies, he's saying, my hour has arrived. My hour has arrived. It's here now. And so we'll draw your attention to that later as we get through those chapters. It's interesting to think, you know, it's like, what was Jesus thinking about when he's there at the wedding feast? What is he thinking about? And I think it's likely here that Jesus is thinking ahead about his whole mission, why he's come to the earth. The wine at the Last Supper is on his mind, symbolizing his blood. If you pay attention reading the Gospels, you'll see it really all over. Jesus is very aware, it's at the forefront of his mind, that he's come to die. His whole life is this march toward, in the next section, he's going to be clearing out the temple. Remember when he goes and turns over the tables? And he says, they ask him, what authority do you have to do this? And he says, tear down this temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. And there's this little parenthesis that says, they realize later, he was talking about his body. Tear down this temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. He's very aware that they're going to tear down his body. They're going to kill him. And then he's going to rise again. There's some times where he's very explicit and he's saying, we're going to go up to Jerusalem and this is what's going to happen to the Son of Man. He's going to be betrayed and he's going to be crucified and he's going to rise again on the third day. So he's telling them in the parables Jesus tells, he's talking about his death. He's talking about his own death, his whole mission for coming. When Jesus is anointed by the woman, remember the woman breaks the perfume, the alabaster jar, and anoints his feet with perfume. And she says, he says she's doing it to prepare me for my burial. So again, this is, if you just could get inside Jesus' mind through his whole ministry, he's very aware, this is where I'm going. This is what's going to happen. This is what I'm going to do. In order to rescue sinners, the price has to be paid. The penalty for sin has to be paid, and I've come to do it. And so you'll see that those hints all along through the Gospels, even early on in Jesus' ministry, this is where it's all leading. He's come to give us life, to lay down his life and win our salvation. Okay, last thing here that I wanted to share about part of Jesus' mission. He's using signs. It says this is the first of his signs. Jesus is using signs to show his glory and draw people to himself. So at the very end of the section there in verse 11, it says that he thus revealed his glory. He's showing a bit of himself. He's showing a bit of his glory. He's not showing the full amount of his glory. That will come later. But he's giving a hint now of his glory. And it says the disciples put their faith in him. And this is what he wants. Jesus is using his miracles to draw people to himself. He's not trying to overwhelm them. He's not trying to force people to believe in them. He's just unveiling a little bit at a time to draw people into relationship with himself. And if I could just contrast this, if you think about a magician like Penn and Teller, or I don't know who the other famous magicians are right now. A magician does tricks. It's not really supernatural. They're doing tricks to make money. They don't really want to draw people to themselves. They want to draw people to their shows so they can make money. if you, you know, became a big fan of a famous magician and you somehow like snuck backstage and knocked on the dressing room door, hey, what are you doing back here? Call security. Give me my space. I don't want you in here, right? Contrast that with Jesus. Jesus is not doing tricks. He's using real supernatural power, and he doesn't want his space. He's using it to draw you, to draw me, to draw us to himself. He wants you to come. He wants you to come back to the dressing room and talk to you and share his life with you. You see how it's different? Jesus is saying, come to me. Magician would say, keep your distance, stay away, back off. But Jesus is saying, come to me. I want you to come follow me. I want you to come sit at my feet and listen to me. I want to fill you with blessing. I want to show you who I am. And this is just the beginning. In John 6:37, Jesus says later, whoever comes to me, I will never drive away. Isn't that wonderful? Whoever comes to me, I will never drive away. So when you look at the water and the wine, it's like on one level, yeah, that's amazing. Jesus turned the water into wine. It's more amazing because he wants to use that to say, come get to know me. Come have life in me. Come experience the blessing that I want to give. Just to close now, God had turned water to blood in Egypt as an expression of his wrath. But now here he turns water to wine to show his glory, to reveal his heart of love and joy and desire for fellowship. And so I just want to urge you to let Jesus draw you to himself anew today. Soak up his love and be in awe and worship.